Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 10, Reflections on the 2008 J.K. Rowling Interview, where we will be talking with writer, producer, and J.K. Rowling interviewer Adil Amini about his interview with herself in 2008. As for Reading, Writing, Rolling, I am your host, Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. Today, we're also joined by friend of the show, Dr. Beatrice Groves, author of Literary Illusion in Harry Potter. Hello, John and Bea.
Hi, Katie. Very lovely to be here.
Hello, Katie.
So glad you could join us.
Oklahoma and Oxford, joining you today.
Our special guest today is Adil Amini, writer, producer, and owner-editor of Press Play OK, a music website, who interviewed J.K. Rowling at the pivotal point of 2008, shortly after the last book was published, and at the beginning of what people feared would be the Potter apocalypse. Adil, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's just get started because it's such a great story about how you got this interview. So you were a journalism student, and how did you manage to land an interview with J.K. Rowling?
Well, Katie, like all the best stories, it happened by accident. And it was, I've never admitted this to anyone, and I'm a little bit ashamed of saying it right now. I didn't recognize Joe in Starbucks. So bad, I know. It's really terrible. This whole thing wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for my really good friend Jane, who I lived with in Edinburgh, and she and I were in the Starbucks near the campus, and she said, "Neil, I think that's J.K. Rowling," and I genuinely shrugged my shoulders, and I was like, well, "I wouldn't know either way. I'm so sorry. I've never read any of the books, and I don't know if you're right or not. I just don't." And we didn't really have, like, there weren't smartphones in the same way then, so I couldn't really, like, Google anything or, you know, look it up. And she's like, no, I'm sure that's her. She lives in Edinburgh. She's there, and, you know, she's in a Starbucks. And then I just thought, okay, well, you know, she's, you know, I know her name, obviously. And I was editor of the student newspaper at the time, so maybe I should just go and talk to her. And to see if she would be up for doing an interview with the paper. And that is exactly what I did. And I think it's because I didn't really know about the books. You know, obviously I was aware of them. I'd seen some of the films. I'd actually reviewed some of the films for the student newspaper. But I didn't have that sense of intimidation, I think, that maybe people might have had. And I literally went up and said to her, "Are you J.K. Rowling?" And she said, "Well, yes, I am." And I said, I am the editor of the Edinburgh Student newspaper. And we'd, you know, if you're up for it, it'd be great to you know, have you in for an interview." And she said, "That would be lovely." And she got a scrap piece of paper, which I still kept. And she wrote her PA's email address on there and said, "Get in touch with this lady. And I'm sure we can sort something out." And that was it, really. And I sort of left and thought, okay, great, I'll just email that person. And yeah, that's how it all happened.
That's amazing. Oh my gosh. How funny that you didn't even recognize her.
Ooh, I'm not proud of this.
Well, Adil, you need to know that I don't know if I speak for Bea or Katie, but I mean, I at that point, I'd already written two or three books on the series, which had been sent to Rowling. My publishers had tried to contact her. I've sent her notes inside my books. Never a ripple of response, that the presence was in her castle and there was no bridging that moat. And to hear that a man who didn't even recognize her, who hadn't read the books, walks up to her and says, "Hey, how about it?" And she's like, "Sure, you know, why not?" You know? Well, I want to do the reverse Gilderoy thing and say, you know, frankly, praise God she never accepted my interview, because the way that you handled the interview was so much better than what I would have done. Your observational skills, your playing with her in terms of your pushing back on certain answers to questions, really, for a student interviewer who hadn't read the books, this is borderline miraculous, the product that you put out. I've talked with Bea and Katie about this. This is one of the top two or three interviews in more than 20 years of interviews. It's a remarkable achievement, and it's a real grace that's now available again. I want to really thank you for reposting it and for the original interview. Anyway, enough. I'm doing the fangirl thing again, Katie.
It's really nice to hear these things, because I think, you know, when you haven't addressed or looked at something for the last 10 years, and it has been, you know, a pivotal moment in my life, I kind of put my blinkers on. And I think one of the reasons I did share it was because of the way that you talked about it, John. And I didn't realize that it had such an impact, because, like I say, I put my head down, you know, it was a thing that happened, and I didn't realize what the wider impact was. And it's really nice to hear that. All I can say is that, you know, I don't particularly feel I did anything special. I, you know, went in and I prepared. I'm a very lucky individual, is all I would say. You know, I happened to be in that place at that time, and it resulted in this. And all I would say is that, you know, I'm sure, you know, if you had the opportunity, you would produce an equally great interview.
Yeah, for me, it was... Yeah, right. Okay.
You know, I'm very fortunate.
Again, this is a little bit like Aristotle's comment that the virtuous man doesn't understand his own virtues, and you don't understand your own strengths, and you're an extraordinary journalist and reporter. Am I talking smoke? B knows the interviews better than anybody.
No, absolutely. No, it is definitely one of the best interviews, and it's the only interview which has got her to acknowledge that she understands a Christian interpretation of her books. So she has said, she said things like, she said Harry has Messiah traits. I did that on purpose. That's the other biggest thing. But where she, this quote in your interview, Adil, where she is quoting Connie Neal and saying that the books were the Christian church's biggest opportunity, was extraordinary, because she's normally extremely cautious of saying anything that could be seen as bigging herself up. So obviously that's quite a major thing to say. And also she's extremely cautious of saying she's preaching in the book. She never wants to be seen as moralistic or preaching. So I think even as a quote, that was quite an extraordinary thing for her to come out with. And I suspect she wouldn't have done it if she wasn't feeling very relaxed with you. And that was something that really, helped.
All I could say is I'm glad that, you know, these things have come out. And like I say, as somebody who, you know, was sort of shielded from the aftermath in a way, I didn't realize any of this. So this is all new to me, and it's really nice to hear. But yeah, it's lovely to hear these words about something that you've written, even though it was so long ago. So thank you all very much. I'm feeling very humbled, and I'm going to leave here with a massive ego. Is that it now? Can I go? Because I'm just going to leave now.
Well, I mean, I should tell you, Adil, that I was during the Potter panic, I was largely Rowling's apologist from the Christian community that had embraced her work. And she had said things like in 2000, she said that she would talk about her Christian faith, except it would reveal where the books were going to go, that readers ages 6 to 60 would understand the ending, and she talked about her Christian faith. And then after the last book came out, she told MTV that she thought the Christian symbolism was obvious. But besides those little tokens, we didn't have any real sign that it had as much Christian content as there obviously is in the books. And your interview, as B said, she almost as an aside, she just says, you know, basically, how could you be so stupid as not to have seen this? That was the biggest sop that we got among the apologists for her work. Anyway, I'm embarrassed. I'm looking at Katie's picture here, and I'm saying, John, stop fangirling the deal. You know, stop doing it. But it was a very big deal when this interview came out. My inbox was filled with owls globally. People saying, we got it. We finally got it. You know, it's done. So that was a big moment for us. But that was an aside in a very long interview. There's so many other things to talk about.
Adil, why do you think Rowling did say yes to you when she'd said no to so many people?
Honestly, I think it was because of the university that I represented. I think, with her living in Edinburgh and me being part of that university and being the editor of the student newspaper, which is the oldest student newspaper in this country, founded by a woman. So it was, I was quite happy to be, the editor at that time. I think at that point as well, I was one of the first sort of people of colour, certainly probably the first gay Muslim editor of that paper. So, I was quite proud of being in that role as it is. Obviously she didn't know any of these things, but when I said that, I'm just, at the campus around the corner, I'm from, here. And I think it was also probably just the sheer brass of me going up there, putting it down. I think, you guys have been very kind to, you said some lovely things, and maybe she got that as well and realized that actually he's probably quite harmless. He's not going to do anything. I'd like to think, I can't remember it, fully, but I would like to think I approached her with respect and sort of, as you would anyone really, rather than saying, hey, you should do this thing and, all that kind of fangirling. So I think that would be the reason, in my opinion, but she would know better.
The agent who you contacted and things, did they say anything about questions you may or might not ask, or did they want to see your questions in advance, any of that kind of thing?
You know what, I actually dug out the emails earlier today just to sort of refresh and give myself a sort of refresh my memory of what it was all like in that whole time period. And I was so surprised to see that all that Joe's PA gave me was a time and a place. It took a few months, but we got there. We had a time and a place, and she's like, Joe's got a lot of meetings in the morning, so she's going to give you 45 minutes, and you have to be prompt. We ended up there for about an hour and a half. It was, things did overrun. There was no interference whatsoever.
She talks in the interview about being rushed by journalists, and now she says, now I'm quite robust about it. I get it now. I understand what the deal is, and I've become hardened to it to an extent. But then I really wasn't. And she's become much more hardened in terms of, especially since she's gone to Neil Blair and the entire thing. She's very much a professional with the press. I think the opening that you exploited magnificently is now closed. No one will approach her in Starbucks anymore and get the PA in an hour. Certainly we know from later interviews that they ask for they vet the questions. They ask for veto power over the final product. This interview this article that you wrote is so insightful about things like just what did you call it? Her amalgam titter. This squirrel girl. This schoolgirl laugh that she had with a mature woman's laugh, combined with it seamlessly. That's a magnificent observation that showed that you had some distance on the subject and that she wasn't able to come back and redline that you didn't want to know that people, she laughed that way. It's a priceless thing.
And also I it's interesting that you say that about the distance, because that was one of the things that I went in there thinking, and because there were so many eyes on this and there's so many people who knew that this was happening in terms of the paper, and I was so desperate for this not to just be a puff piece of me going in there and just paying lip service and rehashing all of these things. So I think that distance that you mentioned was ultimately a great strength, and I'm so proud of that, because I was always more interested in the person and the woman that she had become in the face of all this success than I was in these fictional characters that I didn't have any connection to personally.
And,
I know that's quite a statement, but that's just how I viewed it.
Yeah, and Adil, I think that is one of the great strengths of the interview is you get the human being, you know, you get J.K. Rowling as a person. You talk about how she's like vulnerable and unassuming. And I think that, you know, you were able to see that in her and to talk about that because you were approaching her just as another human being. And I think that's one of the things that really comes through. It's not a puff piece. You know, you were very successful there.
And absolutely. And I think, you know, in that regard, it's the human side of her that informs her work, and you get to see, for example, the Christian input and, you know, her own thoughts on that and how that does infiltrate her work. So in a sense it does, all obviously it does link, but I wanted to go to the source really and get that rather than through the characters.
Absolutely.
I think it's also important, Adil, that the things that John has been describing about how careful she is with the you know, with the professional media, I think that's really important that we've got it from the horse's mouth with you. That isn't how she was with you. This was 2008. Mm. You know, this, she's at absolutely the height of her fame. She could absolutely have asked to see what you'd written and have vetoed things if she didn't like it, and she didn't do that. And my guess is why she didn't do that was that you were not a professional journalist. And this sort of, you know, this carapace that John is describing of privacy is about how she's dealing with the professional, you know, the real media, not being rude about student media, but you know what I mean.
No, absolutely.
It's not incredible invasion of her privacy which had gone on. She didn't connect you with that. And absolutely. As a result, she didn't ask for these unreasonable things from you.
No, absolutely. And so I 100% agree with you. I think the professional thing was something I was going to jump up and make a joke on, which is that I wasn't a professional. I absolutely wasn't. I was a student. I was like fumbling my way through a degree and, you know, had no professional paid journalistic experience other than, you know, what I'd written for the student paper. I think you're right. And I think just picking up on John's point as well about privacy and the way that she is and the way that, you know, she would be now. The world is a very different place 10 years ago.
You know? Oh, boy.
This is pre-Twitter and pre, you know, a lot of things. And I think, obviously, now there is that sense of, you know, anything that she does or says is jumped on. And I think, you know, this is one of the things that I did want to talk about today, and I'm sure we'll get to a little bit later, but is that sense of, it happens with a lot of celebrities, but I think particularly with Jo, because she's written something that so many people love and so many people hold dear to them, that they automatically think that they have ownership of her. And one of the things that really bothers me as somebody, you know, we occasionally do interact on Twitter and things like that, but it bothers me that she is and was a rounded human being with her own opinions and, you know, problems and things before she even wrote these books. And you're ultimately forfeiting that. You're overlooking her strengths as a woman, as a human being, as a writer, and I don't think it's on. And I don't blame her, to be honest. Like, I genuinely don't. Yeah. But I can't imagine what she must have to go through on the daily. I if I did the same to her today, I would turn me down.
Well, let me risk the fangirl thing again to say that what most people remember about this interview certainly isn't her aside about Christianity. It's about how she opened up about her own history of mental illness and going into therapy for it. This was a remarkable revelation. She had said before that she had been depressed and the Dementors were a symbol of that. But in a conversation with a University of Edinburgh journalist, she decides that she is going to bare all, basically, about her experience with her doctors, the therapy that she went through, how hard the work it was, and what a transition it was, how it changed her relationship with her daughter. She all but undresses herself in terms of her autobiography in front of you, Adil, which you had some issues with. I mean, one of the reasons you took this thing down. I wanted you to, if you could talk about what that was like. What do you think prompted her to be that open and honest about her history, and then why? You know, your response to the media's response to that.
Do you know what? I've thought about this a fair amount, and again, it's kind of hard. You know, in something 10 years ago, I can barely remember what I did 10 days ago. But you know, 10 years ago, putting myself in that position and thinking, you know, at that point, it was such a natural, free-flowing conversation that I didn't believe that she had disclosed some major truth about herself all I'd felt was that there were two people talking and she just happened to mention this thing that was part of a story that she was telling. I do think it was something to do with the youth aspect. You know, I was 22 at the time and we were talking about young people and depression and how it's an increasingly, you know, it was increasingly prevalent at the time. And mental health wasn't spoken about so openly. I, at the time, was going through my own issues. And I was not in counselling at that point, but I was certainly aware that something wasn't quite right, you know, with my own issues of struggling of being Muslim and gay and a lot of those other things. And I don't think I would be far off in thinking that maybe Jo saw a bit of herself in me at that time. I think I certainly carried myself in a certain way. I had certain hallmarks of, you know, maybe some of the things that she's experienced, and we did talk about those things. So yeah, I think I've tried to mention this to her in some ways, but at that time I did not realize how much of my own life she was about to affect, and I don't just mean professionally. You know, the thing that I took away, and I think I wrote this in the interview, was that she was so content with just being level and having a family and having, you know, the things that, you know, most people take for granted. And I craved that at the time. You know, even now to this point, I'm kind of thinking, like, you know what, that would, you know, success can come and go and, you know, you can do whatever. But, you know, to have just those basics that, you know, people who suffer from depression, or in my case, you know, as I found out only a couple of years ago, it was borderline personality disorder. The things that you know, we haven't had, and the things that, you know, we crave, I would say, that other people seem to make look very natural and easy. And I think, yeah, maybe I was going through the struggle that she had already gone through.
So you think maybe she was responding directly to you, that in some senses, when she talks in this about... Basically, she's saying here, you know, if these are your problems, you should go and get help for them. That was perhaps something she was directly saying to you.
If she was, she'd be very insightful, because I have a remarkable ability to deflect and hide things, which probably led to a lot of the issues that I had later on in my life anyway, because I wasn't very open about it. So I didn't want to admit to myself at the time, because, you know, coming from the background that I do and the environment that I do, and also, you know, there's this pressure to... You know, social media was just starting out, and this pressure to look and appear a certain way. I think I was in denial about it myself. So if she had seen through that, then that was incredibly insightful. But I kind of painted it in a way of, like, this is something that affects young people at the moment. You know, this is, how do you sort of think of that? And maybe, yeah, subconsciously, it was very, very veiled in that sense.
Well, two things, though, so, here is that she realized that she had exposed herself tremendously, because she, at one point, she just closes the conversation down and goes to a discussion of how people treat young people nowadays. I mean, she just does a 90-degree pivot away from her own exposure, which brings me back to, you know, if anybody remembers your interview that's not a Potter pundit, because of this long break, it's because of the flood of stories that came out of it in the news. And it was all about rolling suicidal, rolling in therapy, rolling has these issues, to the detriment of everything else that was said inside the interview. That became the lead story and the headline and what we had to respond to, you know, online. What was your feeling about that?
I think you've answered the question in your description there. I mean, when you hear those words and the way that it was painted, it just has instantly taken me back to why I took it down. Because nobody wants that. Nobody wants, you know, it became very salacious. It was a sensationalist media twisting, you know, an aside that, rightly so, you know what, you know, we've talked about this, I think, John, you and I, in emails, perhaps, I think it was, but it was... if I felt that they were doing this for the benefit of raising mental health awareness, of course I would have been supportive, but I didn't think that they were doing that, and I don't think anyone thought that they were doing that. I still have all the articles, you know, it's from everything from the front page of the Sunday Times to People magazine, and everyone, they hounded me, you know, they had grabbed my number from places, they were looking for a quote, and I stupidly gave, you know, I talked about it to the Sunday Times. And that's where it all spiraled. And as soon as I'd realized what I'd done, I just thought somebody was interested in the experience so that I could maybe get a job there. And, you know, that's why they were talking to me. Little did I know. And funnily enough, that whole experience was what took me away from journalism. And I realized that I didn't want to be part of such a cutthroat industry that does
this. Wow, what a loss. What a loss.
I don't think so. Do you know what? I don't think so at all, because I think all I needed from that was to know that I was a good interviewer, and that's what I got. And, you know, even now, I will not rest on the laurels of something that I did 10 years ago. It's just not, you know, it's yesterday's news. It's not important. But I did that. I did a thing. I proved something to myself. It's something that I'll carry with me for the rest of my life. It's an incredible achievement that I'm really proud of. But I, you know, once it was done, it was done. And unfortunately, at that point, it was Easter weekend as well. I remember emailing Joe's people, and I've been digging those emails out today. And I said, look, I'm so sorry that this has happened. I would like to pass my apologies on to Joe, because, you know, the media's twisted this. Her agents then called me and said, you know, what have you done? And I'm like, I have no control over this. I have no control. Like, I know that you already gave me permission to print it in the student newspaper. They have taken it from there. Yes, I did put it on my website, and then I immediately took it down, because I was just like, I don't want to benefit or earn money from somebody else's hounding and misfortune in any way. And I felt like I really let Joe down. Like, you know,
Oh my goodness!
I felt like, you know, it wasn't under my control, but I could control it in a certain way, in that, like, people are taking something, so, you know, that they just, it became a bit of a circus. Then I can stop it at the source. And that was one of the reasons I did take it down, because I thought, this is not going to happen on my watch. You know, it's out there. People know about it. You know, the quotes are going to live on. But there's no need for people to, you know, dig it out over and over again. And the difference that I see now, 10 years later, is that now mental health is being talked about in those ways. And actually what Joe said, instead of being, oh my God, Joe Rowling tried to kill herself, is now, oh my God, Joe Rowling is an important proponent for mental health and getting therapy and talking about these things, and she's a great advocate of all of that, and that's one of the reasons why it's back up.
I feel differently than you, John, about her moving, because I think actually she actually talks a lot about it, and she has this phrase which I really like, because she just says, I'm abnormally shameless on this account, because what's is there to be ashamed of, she says. And I think that's a really important little phrase to have there about mental health, and just say, you know, it's like getting a broken leg or something. No one says to you, you should be ashamed of the fact you're unwell. And she just says, I'm not ashamed. Yeah. And that's not what was picked up and quoted, obviously, but there it is. And I think that's a really great line to just have for the discussion of mental health in the wider world. It's just to say, yes.
That quotation, though, B, is immediately after she has described her difficulty in going to her GP, the fact that she wouldn't go back when the GP did not respond to her interviews. That if she wasn't ashamed of it when she had the depression, after the depression, she's not ashamed of it.
But it's not shame. That's not why you don't go out. That's about the fact that people with depression can't reach out. It doesn't have to be a shame feeling. It's just a inaction feeling. So you can't reach out and do anything. So you try. She worked herself up to managing to reach out and go to her GP. And then when she's sent back home, that's it. She hasn't got any energy left to reach out again. So I don't think that has to be related to shame at all.
I'm going to, again, say something that, you know, pretend you're not here, Adil. I'll talk to Katie and Bea about this. Here is a young man that is a journalist. He's the editor of the school newspaper, you know, the most important university in Edinburgh, and basically looking at a career in journalism, who has landed an interview with the you know, the hottest interview globally possible, has written a magnificent article about it, which has gone global, and because of his ethical misgivings about how it's been misused, pulls it down. And it disappears because he thought it was just the right thing to do, though it had a cost. I mean, you didn't count that cost, to your credit, but it had a cost in terms of the opportunities that were available to you. This was a borderline heroic gesture for the person that you had interviewed. I see how it meant that you weren't, you know, cut out to be that kind of Rita Skeeter journalist, but really something I have to note with admiration that you took that point, not because someone told you to take it down, not because you saw it being any kind of advantage to you or anything like that, but that it was just the right thing to do. So cheers to you, Adil, on this.
Thank you so much. And I think, you know, the only thing I'm going to pick up on there is the word heroic. And I don't think of it in that way at all, which obviously by now, and I'm sure your listeners are very bored of me talking in this way, but, you know, it's just not how I would see those things. It is, honestly, mutual respect is what I would chalk it up to, in that, you know, Joe extended such, you know, courtesy to me. And, you know, as two people who spent that time together and talked about a lot of deep things, you know, that is, in my mind, it was a respect thing. So I respect this woman. I respect what she's done. And yeah, it is that. That's kind of what it came down to, rather than any sort of sense of nobility or heroism.
Well, that's in an age of radical materialism, and where individuals are constantly pursuing advantage, you're acting without regard for your advantage. I would qualify as heroic. I know you don't want to wear that mantle, fine. But it is what it is.
And also, just going back to, I just wanted to really pick up on what B said about mental health, and I do agree with it. And because the only reason I'm bringing this back up again is because it's such a it's a subject that's so close to my heart. Like, I've written a lot of pieces on Medium about my own diagnosed borderline personality disorder. You know, I've been through the same things that Joe has. You know, suicide attempts, all of that stuff. And B is right. You know, in terms of that anxiety and the shame about going and getting help, and that it shouldn't be shameful. However, those words often only come from people who have suffered those things themselves. And when you get to journalism and the way that this interview was picked up, all of that was thrown out the window. And it was painted in such a way that people, you know, for example, me or anyone else going through a mental health issue would have then continued to feel ashamed of it. Because they're like, okay, this is now a sensationalist piece. You know, a famous author has you know, tried to kill herself, and it's also dramatic and, you know, whatever. And of course, you know, the way that, I'm glad that things people are talking about, but it's right, you know, Joe is right. It shouldn't be anything that you should be ashamed of. However, at that point, it was still being portrayed in that way. So I just wanted to pick up on that and say that, you know, I do agree with you, B, on that one.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that is so clear coming from the interview is that she's just trying to say, you know, I was a normal person, you know. As a young person, I had struggles and there were these problems, and I was able to get help, and I was helped by somebody who, you know, my doctor, who then noticed I had been turned away and contacted me again. And she talks about cognitive behavioral therapy being so important. And I think that can be really useful and helpful. And I think a lot of people now do think of it. A lot of her fans think of it that way, mm-hmm. think, you know, oh, you know, J.K. Rowling struggles with the same kind of thing that I had struggled with, and maybe I'll be able to find equilibrium too. But the sensationalism of the media blitz about it, just totally, I think you're, I can understand why it sort of seemed to be really the opposite of what that interview really could have, should have been doing in terms of mental health.
Yeah. So I know it seems like quite a sensationalist reaction, almost a bit dramatic, you know, when people are like, oh my God, you took it down for so long. But, you know, in a way, the reason I'm talking about this today, and the reason that I'm doing this 10, well, it's 10 years, and I said to John once, so, you know, if you can't do something like this, you know, 10 years after it happened, then when can you do it? Because, you know, God knows where I'm going to be in another 10. So it was one of the things I'm just like, do you know what? I need to also make my peace with this. I need to talk about it and explain why. And for people to understand that, you know, this wasn't, you know, some sort of, like I say, some crazy gesture that you know, I just wanted to do for a certain reason. It was very thought out, and talking about it again reminds me that I don't regret my decision for a single second.
Well, and as you pointed out, the that was not the only thing in the interview. There were so many other points to the interview, and we definitely want to talk about some of those too. One of the things that is sort of notable in terms of the timing of the interview is that you had approached her not long after her Carnegie Hall appearance in the United States, where she was answering questions. And I was very, very fortunate to actually be in the audience for that, because my friend Amy Sturgis had invited me. She won a sweepstakes, and then I got to go to this. So that was amazing. We had the best time. And the revelation from that, again, this is actually not the one I would have come away with, but the one that the media picked up particularly was her revelation when a fan had asked her about whether Dumbledore had ever been in love. And she said, well, I've always thought of Dumbledore as gay. And she talked a little bit about her response to the Führer. I loved her depiction of going back to the hotel room after that, and Fox News has Dumbledore is gay on the ticker tape at the bottom. And what did you think of her response to that media Führer?
I don't know. I mean, weirdly, it was that element of it was slightly uncomfortable to me because I was wrestling with my own sexuality at the time. So I was kind of asking those questions, but also not really knowing how to respond because I wasn't an out gay man at the time. Whereas I feel like, you know, that's probably something that I would be doing differently now because I understand that world a lot more. I understand, you know, what the implications are and you know, sort of talking about in that sense. So, you know, I can see why she reacted in that way, but the thing that I picked up on the interview and the thing that I still stand by, the thing that, you know, all the discussions about Fantastic Beasts at the moment is the quote that she did say in the interview, which is the issue is love, not sex. And I think even now it's interesting that a lot of people conflate the two, like, you know, immediately you talk about a gay character and for some reason people's mind seems to go to the sexual act. And it's never been about that person. So that's something that, you know, I think she's still held on to. And I think even now she doesn't sort of, it's not an issue in that sense. Like, you know, being gay is not about, right, who you're going to sleep with or whatever. But it's just like, yeah, he was in love and it happened to be a man. Great. Big whoop. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, I think that that's, I was just struck by that passage that's in the interview where she does say that she thinks that a lot of what people are afraid of is the loving that people are, that two, you know, two men or two women are loving each other and are in a loving relationship. And I also was sort of amazed that she basically says, you know, yes, Dumbledore has a big secret in his past, but it's not that he was in love with a man.
Bingo.
That, you know, he was maybe tempted to this, you know, dark side of, you know, wizard power over muggles. That's the secret that he's sort of wrestling with. And I thought that was such an interesting way to turn it.
And this is the thing about Joe as well, is that I've realized, and you know, it's something I've written in the opening passage and the introduction of the piece, you know, when I put it on Medium again, is that with Joe, she was saying these things before Twitter, before, you know, the Me Too movements, before LGBT rights were, you know, is a little bit further on. You know, 10 years ago, things were, you know, they were different. And what struck me about Joe is that she was an ally before people even knew, you know, what that term meant in the truest sense, in that I've always thought of her as an LGBT ally, an ally for minorities. You know, she gave a young Asian journalist in the UK the biggest interview of his life. And it's like, do you know what, there's this notion at the moment on Twitter of performative wokeness, it is, and that is that, you know, people are, you know, trying to earn brownie points by being outraged at a lot of things, or, you know, and sort of failing to realize where they can be allies, how they can battle systemic racism, or, you know, stand up for rights. And Jo's always done that in a weird way, and that's something that I've always respected her for, even, you know, even now. I think despite the harassment she gets on Twitter, I kind of think, well, she's done way more for minorities and gay people than you can even, you know. And again, it comes back to that collective ownership thing, is it, like, you think that you own her, she should do certain things. Yes, I don't agree with, you know, a lot of things that my friends do, but who does? Like, you know, there are certain actions and certain things that you don't always agree with your friends about, but you know that they're a good person, you know that where they've come from, you know their history, you know their past. And that's really how I feel about Joe at the moment.
Yeah, that's wonderfully put. I, you know, this I talk about media exploitation, you know, about the mental illness. There was also this you know, there were T-shirts the next day in New York saying, you know, I'm a gay wizard. This became a sort of a celebration in your face thing. When Rowling had said the big secret was that he had been tempted to the same fault that the Dark Lord, he had the same vision as the Dark Lord does that he's fighting inside the series, and that he was afraid of love, of really any kind of intimacy per se, because he had lost his moral compass. And that's what Dumbledore was about, was his moral compass. And so that his own fears about his sexuality or any kind of intimacy was that he would lose that bearing, that hold to principle that really defined him. and your comment in that interview about that he's not a gay character. He's a character that just happens to be gay, and that Rowling concurred wholeheartedly with that assertion. I mean, that is totally lost in the furor that we experienced then at the interview, and now with the whole Fantastic Beasts controversy, is that Rowling is about this character and what is really important about them, not about scoring points by virtue signaling.
No, but this is one criticism I do have, and that is that, you know, with the utmost respect I say this, but as a middle-class white woman, she can say that. And what I mean by that is that she doesn't understand how powerful visibility and being explicit in, you know, yes, you know, oh, he happened to be gay and he's a character. You know, she can say that, that's fine. But for people who it actually affects, for children, for example, growing up in a Muslim household who don't have any gay characters to relate to, or who don't have, you know, there hasn't been that visibility in pop culture, you know, maybe just saying it or maybe representing it a little bit more. I know she doesn't want to be exploitative, but actually that could have an impact, and that could change how somebody sees themselves, or, you know, the shame that they associate with that, or, you know, the rights. So I understand why she's doing it. I understand that, you know, it is, you know, the way that she looks at it. But however, you have to see it from the other side. It's just like, well, actually, this could really, you know, it could help people as well.
But don't you think that you could argue that by making Dumbledore gay, and I would argue that he is gay in the text, in the sense that her reasoning, which she gives in the interview, that nothing but falling in love with Grindelwald explains why she was he was ever taken in by his ideology. And I think you can read that from Harry Potter itself. You don't need her comment. That by making someone implicitly gay in that sense, it allows people who are anti-gay to fall in love with Dumbledore, you know, to, as a character, and then later to realise that something they are ideologically opposed to is something he is, might help them in a way that, but if he's explicitly gay, then those kind of people are turned off him before they kind of... Do you see my point?
I do, and it ultimately comes down to, you know, who do you want to pander to more, or, you know,
pander is a very negative word for how a writer...
But it is, but this is what I say
their readers. Yeah.
No, absolutely, but what I'm trying to say is that by framing it that way, what I like about Jo is that she'll just do what she wants anyway, and, you know, it is for the story. So when I say pander to, it means that, well, honestly, she doesn't really give a shit. So it's all about the, you know,
she's
it is
not
about
pandering
that.
To either side, really.
No, exactly, just, yeah. But I see where you're coming from. Yeah, absolutely. But I think for her, I think at that point, and maybe sometimes at this point as well, with Fantastic Beasts and the things that have been going around it, is that sometimes you just need to look at it from the other side. And I think you can occasionally get, and we all have it. I'm not saying that this is you know, unique to her, but sometimes we can get a bit too blinkered in things, and you do need a different perspective.
With Fantastic Beasts, which is a different thing, but I wondered when watching the first movie of Fantastic Beasts whether the reading of Harry Potter, which links magic itself with being gay and saying there's this sort of secret society that's in open sight but is not realised by the people, and you suddenly discover you're part of it, the whole thing being a sort of metaphor, that seemed to me to be there in Fantastic Beasts because of the link of the link with the repression causing it to go bad. So children who are magical, and who, as they're beginning to realize they're magical, and older adults say, no, you are not allowed to be magical, and they repress it, and then when they repress it within themselves, it goes bad, and then at puberty, becoming sexually active is the moment when it activates itself, as it were. So, and I thought, gosh, she's actually interwoven this entire reading. It seemed to me quite deeply in the fabric of Fantastic Beasts. And so when I saw that movie, I thought an idea of making that her whole world, as it were, a sort of queer reading of it. And so this current feeling that she's sort of abandoned that, and it seems to be quite extraordinary. I was like, God, this is queer reading of Harry Potter I thought was possible, was going on in Fantastic Beasts.
So B,
and I feel, yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, what you're saying is, like, to fans, like, don't look for Dumbledore, Grindelwald to be the, you know, the narrative here, but look at the obscurial, you know.
Exactly,
look at,
and not look at sort of characters who are identified as gay is not the only way that you know, queer reading can go on within a narrative, basically.
But I think at this point in time, Jo is a little bit on the back foot because of, you know, her politics and Twitter, and I think people are, you know, in the casting of certain actors in certain roles and you know, having to stand by that. And I think people will jump on that. And again, I think, you know, unfortunately, we are in this sort of outrage culture where people are overlooking all the good things that she has done and is continuing to do for the sake of, oh, but you're not showing them having sex. So, you know, that's it. And I agree with you.
Bingo.
I think, you know, it's that is, you know, and again, I think this is, you know, like I said, I think, okay, I know that you picked up on that word, but I feel like I ought to clarify, you know, in terms of the word pandering. But she doesn't need to, you know, that's the thing. It's like, you know, people are, I think with Jo as well, it's like, even throughout Harry Potter, where you've had, you know, the Christian readings, you know, all sorts, is that people are going to take her work and they're going to make what they want of it, regardless of what she does or says. Unfortunately, you know, at this point, she's got more of a platform to try and clarify that. But yeah, I think ultimately, I think she knows that this is going to happen anyway. No one is ever going to be fully happy. So what do you do in that case? Just you stay faithful to the story.
And we also have to acknowledge that Fantastic Beasts is a project of which Rowling is a collaborator. I mean, she certainly is, you know, the guider of, you know, she's drafting the story, but this is not like a novel that she's written. They cut 15 scenes out of the shooting script. I mean, the agreed to script, they cut 15 scenes out of that. This is, in a way, not her story. We don't really know what, we certainly don't know the story arc, where it's going to go in five films. And she seems to resent the fact that she's being held to account for, you know, here she is, the most famous narrative release artist of our time, in terms of being able to slowly give you what's going to happen in the rest of the story through the beginnings. She's being judged from the very beginning film or the second film that no one has seen yet. As you say, we live in bizarre times.
Well, I definitely noticed like a shift last year where, you know, she was saying more things about more characters on Twitter, and people were just like, oh, you know, J.K. Rowling just decided that so-and-so was black, or, you know, is whatever. And I'm just like, you know, there was a shift last year, and I do think that at the moment, unfortunately, for some bizarre reason, she's on the back foot, and people are automatically looking for those reasons to, you know, discredit her politics or the things that she does or the things she says, the things that she writes. And that is not the woman that I knew. You know, I'm not claiming to know her, you know, intimately now, but at the same time, it's not the impression of the woman that I got last year. And that's another reason that I put the piece out, because I wanted to remind people of all the good things that she has done and the doors that she has opened. And you know, obviously mine was one of them.
You know, I think it's really interesting to look at this interview. You were talking about, you know, the 10 years, looking back 10 years and all of the changes that you can see and all of that. And one of the things that comes through this interview is, you know, you have her talking a little bit about what she's going to do next. And
yes.
Her future plans. And what's really interesting is that she's basically fulfilled a lot of the things that she said she was going to do. You know, she kind of got out of the school story. She's doing wizarding stories that aren't about school. Fantastic Beasts. We've also got The Next Generation with Cursed Child. She didn't really write that herself exactly, but she approved it, and it focuses on Albus Severus, who she admits, I love that she's like, what a terrible name, but she gets the attention on the middle child there, and then of course the encyclopedia, which I suppose was Pottermore, and so I'm interested whether you have the sense that, you know, did she know she was going to be doing all these things, or did they just sort of happen, did they come to fulfillment, but maybe accidentally? What do you think?
I mean, there's only one real way to answer this, and I'm going to try and frame this in a way that doesn't sound completely condescending, so please, I apologize. But, yes, like, you know the answer to this, but my response is, what do you think?
unacceptable.
I don't know.
Throw the question back at us. I mean, part of me wants. I mean, I'll answer that. I mean, the whole cursed child thing. I mean, she basically said in your interview this fantastic scene where she talks about the epilogue to Deathly Hallows and how she wept. That she had to have Teddy Lupin in the story. She had to show that Harry was the godfather that he didn't have.
Right.
That Harry was this. And then in Cursed Child, the whole premise is the bad dad. You know.
Yeah.
That Harry is a lousy father. It's like, this is not what she was talking about in the in the interview. This is something, you know, completely different. This is, you know, sort of a Broadway West End cliche. Very disappointing, but I get that. You know, yeah, 10 years on, she's done the things that she had in seed when she was talking to you, except for those books that we haven't gotten. I mean, she talks about books, you know, a stand-up comedian novel. She talks about, you know, a children's political fairy tale for kids that are younger than their Harry Potter readers. I mean, there's all sorts of tantalizing things. You're like, where is that manuscript? You know, when do we see these things?
I think, well, obviously she probably got sidetracked with I can't claim to have read any of them, but the crime novels that she writes. I guess, you know, maybe something evolved and you know, went down that road. But what I meant saying, well, what do you guys think, is that I sort of hear that question about all of this, you know, the stuff that she's done, and I my instinct is that, well, ultimately we're dealing with a very very intelligent woman who's built this intricate world and has laced it with so much, political allegory and all sorts. So from my point of view, I'm like, you know, of course it's planned. Like, she's, you know, she is in her own way, she's a wizard. And I do think that all the stuff that she's talked about, and like, of course, yeah, she's ridiculously intelligent, and there's no way that this has all happened by accident.
And yet she says at the beginning of that interview that she sort of felt like, you know, after she finished the last book, what does she say? I can't go in that world anymore. And so at some point she must have, you know, gotten over that feeling or been felt free to go back to it maybe in some different ways.
Yeah, I think time as well. I think, you know, when you've spent so much of your life in any relationship and that suddenly ends, I think you do need a bit of time before you can either see that person or be around that person again. And I think that's definitely what happened to Joe.
Well, one of the parts of the interviews, when we talked a little bit about this at the beginning of our conversation, Adil, she does at the end of the interview, she talks about how young people she worries are feared in contemporary Britain. She's talking about 2008, obviously. We can think about whether that might still be true. And you thought, you pushed back a little bit on that. You thought that she was thinking things maybe were a little worse. You also talk a lot about how she's conveying a sense of concern for especially her young fans, and she's very moved by the fact that they have been profoundly affected by the Harry Potter series, and that it's becoming part of family traditions where people are reading the books together as families. And she seems, you know, very concerned about young people. And I wonder if you think that she had that idea, and that's why the books tend to focus on young people. She's concerned about that, or is that kind of an unexpected side effect that she kind of came around to after she saw the fan responses?
I think, again, I can't read anyone's mind, but I do feel that Joe and I have the same worldview when it comes to things like that. And this is the only sort of response that I can give, because, you know, I know this is how I feel, and I think it might be how she feels, is that this, you know, it's like, you'll have to forgive my really labored metaphor, but it's like, you know, if you look at our time here as sitting on a bus and sitting in a particular seat on the bus. And for me, it's about how am I going to leave that seat in the best condition for the person who comes and sits there after me. And I think that's my approach to, you know, youth and, you know, for example, coming out, because, you know, you kind of think, well, I don't want the future generation to go through what I did and all the shame and all that stuff. And I think Joe realizes that this isn't, you know, this is all borrowed. You know, you don't want to just cling to that seat and make it really fancy for yourself, you know, give it all the accoutrements you want to, and then ultimately die in it. You know, what good is that going to be? And it also just leaves nothing for the person, you know, they have to sit on your rotting corpse or have to deal with the putrid smell that's going to invade the bus. I've really stretched this metaphor. I'm really surprised. I didn't think that I would go this far with it, but I did. And I'm stopping it. I'm going to carry on. But that's what it kind of is. And I think with Jo as well, like, you know, it's so funny. It's so funny that she said that. And I admit I'd forgotten that she said that, because look at what's happening in Florida. And look how young people are being demonized and, you know, sort of think like you don't know what you're doing, when the truth is that a lot of older people who are happy with the status quo are scared of young people. And I think what, you know, she was, again, it's fascinating to look at, because she was so aware of these things before they, you know, became a trend to be aware of. You know, she knew that that's where the power lies, that that's where revolution lies, and that's where, you know, change is going to happen. And I think she does it because she respects young people. I don't think it became a side effect. I think it's genuinely that, you know, it is about leaving a legacy, but leaving something positive, leaving, you know, aspirations.
Adil, how much was she looking at you across the table, if you were looking across the table, and say, I'm talking to an Asian man in the United Kingdom. This was obviously pre-Brexit, but she's in Edinburgh. I don't know how large the Asian population is in Edinburgh. I assume it's smaller than it is in London.
Yeah.
And relatively provincial. And she's talking to a young man that is clearly othered by the larger Edinburgh culture here. How much was she simply looking across the table? She pivots to this after she has bared herself about her own experiences. And then she all of a sudden talks about how people perceive young people as being dangerous. How much was she just talking to you?
If she was, then she veiled it very well. I think I always felt, because I think if you think about it, I mean, if she had done that, that would probably have been othering me in a different way.
Yeah.
I think that her ability to have had that conversation, whether she was doing it or not, I don't know, but I certainly didn't feel it. And that's probably, you know, a credit to her. And the way that the chat went, but that I did not feel anything other than an equal. And that's a bizarre thing to say, I know, but that's the respect that she gives people, and the respect that it was a respect that allowed me to be so comfortable in the things that I asked and the things that I pushed back on, because ultimately I was having a conversation with somebody who felt like a friend. And I think that, you know, she treated me as an equal and didn't other me in any way either, you know, for patronizing reasons or anything else.
I love that you say that she respects young people, because I think that that comes through in her books. This is one of the things that we talk about. You know, it's not, she doesn't talk down to her readers. She doesn't talk down to children. She doesn't minimize their experiences. They're real, and they're in fact at the center of everything that she's doing in those Harry Potter books. And so I think that totally comes through. That's so interesting.
Mm.
And I think to pick up on that with Casual Vacancy, which is one of these, when I read reviews of Casual Vacancy, I just read these people saying, gosh, everybody in this novel is so horrible. And I thought, you know, have these reviewers not been paying any attention to the younger people in this novel? Because all the adults are horrible. Teenagers aren't all horrible. And I just sort of thought, this is a classic adult response to this novel. Is actually about the teenagers in it, not about the adults. But adult readers assume that this novel must be about the adults because there are adults there. And I thought she's getting this continued interest in young people sort of into an adult novel, and people have just not even spotted that it's there.
Well, this is a funny thing, isn't it? It's the dichotomy that kind of, you know, came out when I read the interview again, and I thought, well, you know, on one hand, you're talking about all the people who have slagged you off and said all of these horrible things. And on the other hand, you're talking about these generations of people who have shown you unconditional love. What is the difference between those two groups? Age. You know, and I kind of think, you know, that's the people that have given her grief in her life have largely been adults. So I'm not surprised that, you know, she has to spend. But also, like I say, it's a respect thing. It's to know that, you know what, she knows that she's not going to be here forever. We all know that. But it's like, right, what can I do to, you know, and I think that also informs a lot of her charitable work as well, is that what can I do to make this world a slightly better place for the younger people when I go?
Yeah, that is, I mean, to push back on something you said earlier, you know, Rowling's biggest change since that interview has been the change in focus from Harry Potter, where she was creating an artistic legacy, to her decision that her legacy will be what started out as the Children's High Level Group and then became Lumos, that's going to be her recent decoration from, you know, Windsor Castle, wherever the Queen lives, wasn't for contributions to children's literature or to literature, but to philanthropy. And that this has become her focus, and that she's gone back to the Wizarding World, not because there's some great need to explore more about Wizarding World, but that she can create the money for the Volant Trust and for Lumos that she can't do through her Cormoran Strike novels.
Yeah.
I mean, she even mentions, I think your interview is the first time she mentions the hint of the Strike books, where she says, "And the other thing, I don't know whether that will ever see the light of day, but it's just fun to write." We know that she had said that she is working on the Silkworm novel 5 or 6 years before it came out. That, I mean, she told Melissa and Nelly a year or so on from that she was having a love affair. The writing was so much fun that she may have been talking about the Cormoran Strike, but that was never going to pay the bills or the notes that she was putting out there in terms of saving children all through Eastern Europe and the globe.
Yeah.
That her emphasis has really changed, and hence the return to the Wizarding World, which will always be, you know, the gold mine or the diamond mine for her.
Yeah, I think that's very valid.
So, Adil, you've already talked a little bit about why you decided to re-release the interview on the 10th anniversary, and you've indicated that it has something to do with the fans as well. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about your reasoning for reposting.
As I've mentioned earlier, I, you know, wanted to sort of make peace with it. It was something that, you know, was a big part of my life. It was a huge deal. And I think now, 10 years later, you know, after all the various trials that I've been through myself, whether it's with my own writing or personal life, I kind of just wanted to not close that chapter, because I think, you know, I never want to not talk about it, but I wanted to be more comfortable with it. And I think it's a testament to the three of you that you created an environment through the initial emails and through this podcast that you have allowed me to do that. And I'm always going to be grateful for that, because I've never been able to talk about the interview in such depth. And I wouldn't have done it, because funnily enough, before John emailed me, somebody from, I think, a Swedish university had said, "Could you give me the full text?" And I said no. I just didn't feel comfortable. I didn't want to do it. And their approach was so impersonal, and it felt a bit more exploitative again, and I just absolutely point blank refused. And that was only in December. So
we're very glad we've talked you around, Adil.
you're all very, you know, it's clearly you're all very passionate about the subject, about Joe, about the interview. And honestly, this, again, it sounds needlessly noble, and I really don't mean it to sound that way, but I don't feel like this belongs to me anymore. It's not my thing. It's, you know, ultimately I was a vehicle for Joe to say those things, and those things have been said and they're out there. So it's not mine to covet. Those words are out there. They should be enjoyed by other people, by people who are so, you know, wedded to that world, and it means a lot of, you know, it means a lot to them. It means a lot for their studies and, you know, for their knowledge. And that's the reason that I just feel like it's not mine. It's you. It belongs to you guys.
Well, thank you so much, Adil. This is it's really revelatory, and there's so many wonderful tidbits in for Harry Potter scholars. So it is a gift to us, but I think for all the fans to be able to see her in such a human conversation, it's just wonderful. Now, but I do have to ask you. You did admit to her at the end of the interview that you had not read any of the books, and she laughed, which is a wonderful reaction, right? She's not upset about that. But I wondered why you didn't read them in advance and whether you've read them yet.
I can answer the first one, and the reason for that is what I said earlier, is that I didn't. I'd read interviews by fans. There was an ITV documentary as well. There was a lot of focus on the films, and I didn't want to be. I knew about the Dementors, I knew about certain things, obviously Dumbledore and a lot of the headlines, but I didn't want to go in there as a fan. I wanted to go in there wanting to do a profile piece on the person. And I thought if I had gone down that road, I feel like it, you know, if I had become wedded to that world, it would have taken a little bit of that away. And I didn't want to dilute the sort of resolve that I was going in with, which is why I didn't read them. And then obviously I got a signed copy, which now my nephew reads. Have I read the novel since then? This is the point of the podcast where I regret having my video thing open for you guys to see. Because for the people listening, it is filled with shame.
That's what else we need.
I mean, look, it passed me by. It was so great at the time, and I feel like, you know what, I got a great deal out of that whole thing. But I was like, really, what more could it get? You know, if I ever came across Joe again, and you know, I got the opportunity again, maybe I would. But I feel like there's so much more to talk about now, and I don't really. No, like I say, it's like, you know, it's a weird one, because once you've been so involved with the person behind it, the work, you know, I know it's great work, but it just, I don't know, I feel like, yeah, it's an odd relationship I have with Harry Potter.
Really, yeah, you need to read the Cormoran Strike books.
If you had the interview again, then Adil, was there any question you wish you'd asked or that you'd like to ask now?
I don't wish I'd done anything differently. I think if anything, you know, I was at a certain point in my life, and I do realise that, well, only through the course of this interview, that had I been more okay with my sexuality at the time, I probably would have approached that particular aspect differently, because I would perhaps have more to relate it to and a more informed perspective, but I just didn't at that time. But there's nothing I wish I'd done differently. You know, like I say, that interview, I'm very proud of it. If I had attacked it in any different way, it wouldn't be the piece that it is.
If you had an interview with her now, is there, what question would you like to ask now?
Well, see, this is the difference between me and Joe, and that Joe is very generous in giving away, you know, what I think. All I will say is you'll have to find out if that opportunity ever comes again. I would hope that, you know, what is going through my head right now is something that, you know, only I could ask, perhaps. And I would ideally like to give people an interview that they'd still be talking about 10 years down the line as well.
Well, I said earlier that your decision not to really pursue a career in journalism was a great loss, and you seem to suggest it was like it was a loss to you. I wasn't talking about you, Adil. I was talking about the rest of us, and you know, the obviously a gift that you have in these interviews, observation, and your own self-awareness of what posture you want to have going into the interview. I mean, all those things, it's so rare. And the achievement is so significant. I hope someday, soon, you'll decide, you know, maybe I should be doing interviews, you know, professionally with people, to use that gift.
Well, I was going to say, I kind of do in a way. You know, a lot of the stuff that I do for TV, I write for chat shows, I write interviews for celebrities. I mean, it's quite, you know, it's frivolous a lot of the time, but I do a lot there. And for the music website, you know, we interview pop stars, and a couple of those have, you know, hit national headlines in terms of some of the comments that people have made. I think weirdly, after all of this has come out, I've realised that is what I enjoy. And you know, I do various forms of journalism, and you know, for my site, you do reviews and, you know, maybe long form pieces. But interviewing is certainly where I feel like I'm happiest, I'm at home. And you know, that has been one thing that has come out of the discussions, is that it's really reminded me about that, and it's something that I am pursuing. You know, I do my own podcast again with pop stars, and it comes out there. I think just a chance to get to know people is always fun. But you know, hopefully it will turn into something else, who knows. But I think I, having had that break and having done other things, has probably made me a better writer for the experience. Well, hopefully, I was going to say, you know, get Joe on the blower,
yeah, and say, there you go.
10 years, it's been 10 years, come on, you know, water on the bridge, let's have a rematch, come on. I think you would. You know what, yeah. I honestly think, I think if we ever met, you know, I'm not one of those people who's like, you know, I just can't be one of those people who just, you know, is constantly fawning over somebody or pestering them. But I genuinely think if we met and I suggested it, I don't know if she would say no.
Awesome.
Well, you're way ahead of the rest of us, because I'm fairly confident she would say no if I asked her. I mean, she's done it for 15 years. I hope that you'll start doing profiles for the New Yorker and that kind of venue, where really your tremendous skills and self-awareness and your respect for the person that you're interviewing will have a greater audience than what you're getting now on your podcast.
Well, if you'll allow me one last moment of modesty and to bring it, to the subject that is uniting us all here today, people from all over the world, is that when you have a subject as rich and as interesting as Joe Rowling, then the work's already done for you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Adil. I really appreciate your time and attention being interviewed instead of being the interviewer. And you have just been a delightful guest. And I thank you for your generosity, not only in sharing the interview itself, but also just in talking with us about it today. This has just been such a great conversation. And I want to remind our listeners that your website is Press Play OK, and that's where they can get to your podcast and those interviews that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Thanks also, I would say, to our special guest, B. Groves, and also John Granger, for joining us as our kind of co-interviewers today. And a big shout-out to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Emma Nicholson, listeners, you don't know this, is a miracle worker, and she does a wonderful job producing our podcast, so I appreciate that. As always, we appreciate our partners. Also at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, and we very much appreciate all that you're doing to help us get the podcast out there to listeners. And listeners, we're glad that you joined us today. And if you would leave a comment or question or contact us via email at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com. You can tweet us at readwriteroll on Twitter. And also, I have started to try to be a little more active on our Facebook page. So you can like our Facebook page for Reading, Writing, Rolling. And again, let us know what you'd like to hear more about from us. And with that, I will leave you all with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not so humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." So we'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.